The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
A co-founder of the Paris Review and its first fiction editor, Peter Matthewson, is considered one of the most important wilderness writers of the 20th century. He received the National Book Award in 1980 for his memoir, The Snow Leopard, an account of his journey to remote Nepal with wildlife biologist George Schauer, and his 1971 book, Blue Meridian, The Search for the Great White Shark. What Great White Shark is widely believed to have inspired the American cinematic favorite, Jaws. His latest book is Shadow Country. It collects and reworks his lavishly praised epic Watson trilogy that was originally released as the novels Killing Mr. Watson, Lost Man River, and Bone by Bone. Peter Matthewson has done great things with the Watson trilogy, says acclaimed author Don DeLillo. It is the story of our continent, both land and people, and his writing does every justice to the blood fury of his themes. And I can tell you, I started reading this book two nights ago, and you can see where my bookmark is already. It is an incredible read. It is just terrific. So Mr. Matthewson will be interviewed tonight by McKay Jenkins, the Tillman Professor of English at the University of Delaware, editor of the Peter Matthewson Reader, and author himself of The White Death, The Last Ridge, and most recently, Bloody Falls of the Coppermine. So we're very honored to have both of them with us here this evening. So please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming Peter Matthewson and McKay Jenkins.
I guess I should start. Thank you all very much for coming out tonight. I think you will agree with me that it's really quite an honor to be in the presence of Peter Matthewson, who has been a very influential writer in many regards as a nonfiction writer, as a novelist, and as a great eminence on the environmental scene as well over the last half century. What I thought I would do is just start by asking him some questions, and we will carry on for a while. And then you all can ask questions yourselves when we're finished, if that's all right. So I thought we would start at the beginning and ask Peter to relate an anecdote that I've heard him mention a couple of times, which is the reaction of your agent when you handed her your first novel manuscript that you thought was the new great American novel, and she responded somewhat unexpectedly. Can you tell us that story?
You're referring to this present novel?
No, the first novel. After you had a couple of great short stories, this is way back when, but you wrote a novel and you handed it to Bernice.
Oh, yeah. I remember it only too well. Burned into my brain. I had a very tough agent, Bernice Baumgarten by name, and I placed a couple of short stories and on the basis of that set out to write the great American novel, naturally. And it was so great that after I got about 150 pages, I thought, well, listen, American can wait no longer. This thing. So I fired it off to my agent to get a preliminary impression. And I more or less hung around the post office like a village idiot for the next 2 weeks. And to my dismay, this large and bulky package arrived with my manuscript in it. And this note, which I promise you is the note in its entirety, incised in my brain. It said, "Dear Peter, James Fenimore Cooper wrote this 150 years ago, only he wrote it better. Yours, Bernice." And I thought that was obviously, she was, you know, that shot that novel down. I put that one on the shelf. It never did reemerge, and it was masterful, of course, but later on I was living in Paris, and I had a friend called Terry Southern. You may remember Terry Southern. He was a terrible reprobate. He did the screenplay for Dr. Strangelove, and you know how it's, anyway, Terry and I were in Paris, and he said, listen, there's a great contest for short stories going on in England. We should hit that as a jackpot for people as talented as we are. We were both in our 20s, you know, early 20s. So we submitted. There was a theme. You had to write. It had to be somehow Christmas connected. So I hauled out some old anecdote of mine, and Terry did too. And we sent them off. And there were, I think, 500 winners. However, they were compartmentalized. There was only one first place winner, and that was a young British writer whose name is Muriel Spark. And Muriel went on to glory. Terry Southern and I were among the 499 also-rans. And I think we received about $18 each for our story. And I thought, since my agent, Bernice Baumgarten, had wasted so much money on me in stamps and everything else, getting nowhere, I would be courteous and send her her commission on the story, even though she hadn't handled it. And even though it was a pitiable $1.80 for her 10% commission. Anyway, I sent it off thinking she would appreciate the gesture. And the note came back, "Dear Peter, I'm awfully glad you were able to get rid of this story in England, as I do not think we would have had much luck with it here. Yours been here." So I thought that was suitably humbling. And but you know, she was a very, very tough lady indeed, but she was a very good agent, and I think basically good-hearted. She was married to a much, at the time, overrated novelist called James Gould Cousins, who wrote a great successful book called By Love Possessed, a real blockbuster. And that's really neither here nor there. But when she retired as an old lady, she called me in, and she said, tears arced out of my eyes. She said, "I was very, very tough on you because I think you're very, very good." And her theory was kind of a Zen theory, you know, that you are toughest on your best students. And I'm a Zen teacher, so I know how that works. You don't let them get away with anything, and especially arrogance. And all young writers are arrogant, my experience.
While we're on the subject of Zen and writing, I thought I would ask also about something I've read. You said about your novel Far Tortuga, which came after your other novel called A Play in the Fields of the Lord, which is a very ornate kind of colonial drama set in South America, followed by Far Tortuga, which was set in the Caribbean and was written in a very spare kind of experimental style. And I've heard you compare the writing of that to Zen, in that you're trying to scrub the paint down to the very bare wood. And I thought maybe you'd comment a little bit about the link between a Zen practice and especially fiction writing, which seems to be much more liberating for you than nonfiction, which seems a bit more cerebral.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Far Tortuga was a novel that it began as a nonfiction piece for The New Yorker. I heard about this guy who was a old-time wind captain, a sailing schooner down to the Mosquito Keys off the coast of Nicaragua for commercial harvesting of green sea turtles for the Key West market and so forth. And he was still going down there under sail. I couldn't believe that such a guy was still doing that. And I went to Mr. Sean at the New Yorker. He was the new editor there. I said, "I got to go on that ship and I'll do you a..." And he was delighted. But I went on this ship, and it was these guys. They had nothing. We ate barracuda mostly. They had no life-preserving equipment. They had no navigational aids. We were in this tough trade wind atmosphere all the time. They were fishing these reefs. We were on these reefs, wind and wind and wind and wind. And this was their life. They were wonderful seamen. They were actually hired all over the world from Grand Cayman. They're famous sailors. But several things happened on this voyage, and I hadn't thought. I was still doing my New Yorker fact piece, as I call it. But I came back to Mr. Sean, and I said, "Mr. Sean, I'm going to hold back the best stuff. I want to write a novel. And if you'd like, I will repay all the expense money you've given me, which I've done quite a lot. I've been there 3 times. And he is by far my high point as a writer with dealing with editors and publishers in my whole life. Mr. Shawn said without any hesitation, he said, Mr. Matheson, do what's best for your work. He never, without any hesitation, even now I get choked up remembering it. And when he was, Mr. Shawn was kind of rudely booted out a few years ago. And I wrote him a letter and I said, you know, this is my, you will have forgotten this, but this is my high point in publishing. Anyway, the novel I wanted to do on top of I wanted to write about the subject, but the very spareness of these people's equipment and their life and nothing extra, even the paint on the boats, the little rowboats they went out after the turtles with the little nets, all the paint was transparent. It hadn't been, so long since it had been repainted that the gear was just worn down to nothing. There was nothing extra. Nothing lavish. And as McKay said, I just finished this, a couple of years before that, I finished a book called At Play in the Fields of the Lord, which later became a film. Had a dubious fate, but it did become a film. And I didn't like that style I'd used. It was full of metaphor. It suited that book. It was in the jungle and the Amazon and all that kind of thing. And I guess it was okay, but similes and metaphors all over the place. And this book, I wanted no similes. I wanted nothing extra at all. I wanted it right down to the bare wood, you know. And so I evolved this way of presenting it with no he said, no she said. I don't identify the speaker. I give plenty of clues. I have a ship's manifest with the names and the position of the particular skill or whoever the crewman was and who they were and what town they came from and everything. So you have a clue as to who's aboard, and it's only about 9 or 10 guys, so you kind of, they're easy to keep under control. And my feeling was, from observation, is that these guys were all very uneducated fellows, and they all had a life song they sang over and over and over again. And even, I think, if you think about your circle of acquaintance, even much, much better educated people, if you listen carefully, you will hear a life song that accounts for their life and why they made it or why they failed or perhaps not even that dramatic, just kind of who they are. And because of that life song, I think after about 30 pages, you can pick up pretty quickly who's speaking when. But I got rid of that furniture and I had no similes like it was like a, you know, I just described the thing itself, just the antennae on a cockroach sticking its head out from under the cook shack on the deck. It was just these little golden antennae. I didn't say they were like radio antennae or anything. They're just these mysterious, golden, tiny, delicate probes out there picking up smells and sound. And I described the water in an oil drum. They had a lot of oil drums on the deck. You know, an oil drum, if you look at it, it's got a rim around the top, about high. And because the ship is constantly tilted, the rainwater on the top of the rim is always in a little tiny puddle around the bottom edge of the rim. And because of this old diesel engine, it was a half-baked ship. He had sail up, but he also had a diesel engine that didn't work. And because of that, the water in that oil drum was vibrating all the time. So I just had a million details like that, but just give the detail. In Zen, we say, deal with the thing itself. No extra. No, it doesn't need anything. If you properly describe the thing itself, the sound or the smell, it's enormously forceful, and you actually encumber it by making it a. But there was one simile in the book. It got away from me. I only discovered it later. I spoke of Far Tortuga was a mythical island. It was in the captain's mind. This was the island where all the turtles were still plentiful, where he could go and make a great haul and make money and maybe retire one day. And it's called Far Tortuga. Tortuga is Spanish for turtle. Far Turtle Island is what, you know. And I described Far Tortuga as being like a memory in the ocean emptiness. And that's the only like something else in the whole book is in that one. Escape, yeah. But that was, and I was at that time, by that time I was deep into Zen practice, yeah.
Well, you know, the primary occasion for this talk is the publication of his new, now I guess I can call it a new novel. It is actually a rewriting of three novels that I've read over the years, and he has been writing, I think, for 30 years.
Yeah.
One of the longest epic endeavors that I am aware of in American fiction. And you were speaking about following these turtle hunters in the Caribbean, and it makes me wonder also about the research for this book, because if you read it, the density of the language and the density of the conversation and the we all know that Peter's a master at description of inanimate objects. He spent many years writing nonfiction about animals and about landscapes, but the descriptions that come out of or the descriptions of the human beings that live down here in South Florida are so vivid that it makes me wonder about the way you researched this, the way you were able to channel the language that comes out of their mouths. And maybe you could speak a little bit about that.
Well, I do love dialogue. I love the way speech manifests itself. And I think I've got a pretty good ear. I feel to write really good dialect, not dialogue, but dialect, including the dialogue. You kind of have to learn to speak that language first. It's got to come rolling out of you. You can't construct it line by line. Oh, yes, it sounds kind of like redneck talk. Or, you know, it doesn't work that way. It's got to come rolling out spontaneously, I think, if it's going to be good. Sometimes you read it when it's not good, and it sounds very forced. So, and I enjoy it. I like working people. I like rednecks from a certain point of view. Not their politics or their whatever, but I like working people who work with their hands, who live on the edge. They've always attracted me more than the people I grew up with. Not as people, but as subject matter. I know the people. I know the kind of social strata I grew up in and the people I knew, and that they're fine, they're great, but they're not I don't particularly want to write about them just because I knew about them then. I'm much more attracted to people who are out on the edge somewhere. And so in my novels, I write about them. And I am interested in these swamp people down there. I ran into them, a lot of them doing wildlife work, you know, in the background. They're people who feel they're being pushed off the map by the tourist economy, the resort economy. Florida, you know, you get away from the coast, it's a very wild state. Very few people recognize this. It was the biggest, it is now the second biggest cattle state in America. We don't think of, you know, rangeland in Florida, but by God, it is. It's very, very untrafficked. And the whole southern third of the state has no roads whatsoever. The part that became the Everglades National Park and the 10,000 islands and the Big Cypress is really the wildest country we have in the 48 anywhere. And it's got some wild people down there, people who were wanted somewhere else. They all piled up at the bottom of the funnel. And one of them was my character, Mr. Edgar Watson, by name. Sociopathic, arguably, killer. I think I've lost track of your question.
Well, I guess thinking over your career, it seems like there must be four or five of you, because you know, he's written a book about the Himalayas, and he's written a book about several books about Africa, and books about South America, and books about the Arctic, and he's written books about the American West, and he's written books about Long Island, and he's all over the place. And how do you then also manage to turn out a 30-year project about Florida? I mean, how is it that you're simply able, because these are not novels that he sits in his library and imagines. These are all deeply researched and reported firsthand, and I just wonder, you know, how many nights a year do you spend in your own bed, I guess, over the last 50 years?
Well, this book had a kind of a queer inception. My father, he loved, although we came from New England, but he loved the Florida coast. He loved fishing. And he had a boat down there for many years. And we were going up the west coast of Florida, and he showed me on a marine chart. He showed me these great big Everglades rivers all come out into the Gulf of Mexico on the southwest coast of Florida. Big wild rivers, nobody on there. And he showed me this river called Chatham River. And he said, you know, there's a house up there. It's the only house in the Everglades. It's about 3 or 4 miles up that river. There's a house. And we didn't have time that day to go up. And in those days, there still was enough water. Now the Army Corps of Engineers and various agricultural interests and so forth of shunting off the water. But in those days, it was a navigable river. And he had actually seen the house. And he didn't know too much about it. He said that house belonged to a man named Watson, who was killed by his neighbors. Now, this isn't killed by your neighbors in some sort of criminal turf in the suburbs of Philadelphia or New York or someplace. These guys were farmers and fishermen. They aren't people who are going to off their neighbor if they could help it, you know. So that struck in my mind. And he said, I don't know much about the guy except that he was supposed to have been a killer himself. And that's all he said, you know. And I thought, huh, a guy killed by his neighbors, how does that happen? This intrigued me. But I was only about 17 or 18 years old, and by the time I got to work on this, I wanted to do a big novel about the things that were my passions, which were the environment and wildlife, American Indian people, all these things I have been working with. But I needed a kind of a plot thread, and I thought maybe that story about that guy who was killed by his neighbors and lived in the only house in the Everglades, that was a nice kickoff for a story. And by God, I started looking into it. First of all, there were almost no hard facts except what I could find on gravestones. And even very responsible people who wrote about him and mentioned him, they had it all wrong. There's a woman named, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who wrote the great book called River of Grass on the Everglades. She was a very good writer and a very good reporter. And she had 3 pages about Mr. Watson, and they were all wrong, every single fact she had down there. And you could see where they came from. They came from local people who said, oh, this old lady wants a good, colorful story. Let's tell her that he killed 50 people down there. You know, you could see that. And these stories were repeated over and over again, and legend became myth. And the truth about Watson was unknown. Nobody, and all the accounts I read, and I found quite a few, they were all wrong. Nobody mentioned that all of his wives came from Columbia County, Florida, and far in the north, that he himself came from South Carolina, that he had run away to Oklahoma as a younger man, and had apparently been, he was the only one ever taken to court for killing the outlaw woman, Belle Starr. You remember Belle Starr? Guns. And I thought, my God, where is the truth here? You know, so that was the great search. And I tracked him all the way back to South Carolina. He came from Edgefield County, South Carolina, which is a book about it. It is the most violent county in all of North America. There's more wholesale murder, rapine, lynchings, shootings. It also produced, I don't know if there's any connection, but it's produced almost all of South Carolina's governors came from, including Strom Thurmond, right up to the very end. You know, it is a very, very violent place with a very strong history. And so that's where he came from. His family was a very well-to-do family. His father was the first, well, maybe his grandfather. His grandfather was apparently a nice man, but a little wishy-washy in this kind of doer Scots family. And his father was a Civil War soldier, came back, and he was a bad drinker, a violent drinker, a brawler who was finally knocked down in some brawl, and some guy didn't kill him, but he carved a big circle around his eye. His name was Elijah, and he was called Ring Eye Lige, and this was the beginning of the end of this family, and his wife and kids finally fled to Florida to get away from him. Edgar was one of the kids, but having been beaten to a froth by that time. So you, that old cliche about, you know, you beat up a kid as badly as that, you're making a dangerous man. And he became a very, very dangerous man, but also a very able one. And everything I could find out about him, which is, like I say, mainly from gravestones, family accounts, marriage, tax records. But it started to come together because I knew who his family was, and they were still going. His daughter married the president of the bank, the First National Bank in Fort Myers. It was a very distinguished family, but they would not talk about him. You know, Dad gets blown away by his neighbors, 33 bullets worth. In 1910, that's a pretty big scandal, you might say. So the family just completely shut up. They never came to his defense. They didn't account for him in any way. You couldn't get anything out of them. And they, even after I started working on it, they wouldn't come anywhere near me. But piece by piece, they finally did. A grandson over here, somebody else there. You know, what are you doing? And they came out, and I gradually, much too late, I actually met two of his children, his two youngest daughters. I actually met and became very friendly with. And his oldest, his youngest kid is still living. She's a wonderful old lady and living in Central Florida, 97 years old. She denied hotly that she'd ever known her father. She was a baby, actually, and he was killed. And she invites me to her birthday parties, and they've taken me in. And I don't make him a good guy. Nobody could say that. But compared to what was said about him, they said, "You've made him a human being. We can live with this. You've given us back our father." And that part was very, very thrilling. Really, it was so touching. Unfortunately, most of my informants are no longer with us. I was hoping the book would come out in time, but almost all of them are gone. They were old people when I interviewed them, and I'm an old person now. So there's a discrepancy there. I answered that question much too long. I'll be brief.
That's appropriate for the length of the book. Yeah, so if it hadn't taken 30 years, they'd still be here to talk to you.
Right.
Now, you have said, I've read in the past that you when interviewers ask you who your influences are, you say, "I can't really pinpoint any. I sort of absorb fiction through my skin and things come out the way they come out." And I'm going to be so bold as to make a comparison. And for those of you who haven't read this book, see if you don't agree. I think this book reminds me most of all of Absalom, Absalom, which is, in my opinion, Faulkner's great epic achievement. And I'm curious about your thoughts about this. You said about this project that you don't care about the plot, that what you're interested in is the mysteries below the plot. And I'd like you to, if you would, address the mysteries of personality, but also the mysteries of American history. Because as you know, Absalom, Absalom is considered to be one of the great books ever written about the Civil War, although it's fiction. And I think this book captures a kind of American history that is as rich as anything you'll ever read. So maybe talk a little bit about what lies below the plot, both in terms of human character exploration and also American history. And by that I mean regional history and racial history and economic history and that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, the book began, the first book in the original edition, there were three books. The first one was called Killing Mr. Watson. And I kill Mr. Watson right off in the first five or six pages. That little chapter ends with his wife calling out, my God, they're killing Mr. Watson. And he's being blown away on the waterfront there. And you don't know quite how or why, but just this shift of tension and on he's gone. And then it goes right into local voices talking about him, the impression he made in the community when he came there. And then gradually his daughter, her voice comes in. And in the new book, there was a man named Henry Short. Henry Short was a black guy. Henry Short was the only person that could shoot better than Watson. Watson was a crack shot. And Henry was in the crowd that killed Watson, and the rumor was that he had been the first man to shoot, and that after Henry shot, no more shots were necessary. He was a very good shot. Henry, obviously, being a black guy in 1910, that's Jim Crow, that's the height of the worst Jim Crow lynching that was going on in our country, one of the ugliest periods we ever had. What was he doing in that crowd? This is what I heard, the rumor he was there. I thought, holy God, that's not possible. How could he have been there? And why wasn't he killed outright for having been there? That was much more than you would have needed to lynch a guy like that in those days. It was really awful back then. If you did it, and you didn't do it on Sunday in front of the church, you'd kill a black person almost at will in a lot of those communities. It was really horrifying, medieval goings on. So how did that happen? This became more and more the undertone of this book. Shadow Country is the name of this new form of the book. The shadow is the shadow over our great land, but we have a shadow. And our shadow, I think, is racism. We have never put it out of our system, whether it's American Indians or black people or new immigrant people coming and the Chicanos. All my life, this has been something that's absorbed me. So this is the undercurrent. And Henry Short in the new book, I didn't give him a voice in the first form. Now he does have a voice. He comes forward, and you understand him much better as a man and what his problem was. He was the only black man in his community. He had a very, very lonely life. And he went, like many black kids in this situation, he went as a kid, as a little boy, he was raised with the kids of the family. you know, and then at 10 years old or something, they say, you can't live with the boys anymore. You've got to go out and live in the shed. His whole life was a series of terrible humiliations like this, you know. So where was he? What was in his head? What did he feel about Watson personally? And they have a couple of interesting encounters. So all these threads start going. So the first part of the first section is the community's reaction to Watson. And, you know, they say these things, which some of them are quite funny, but they're grim. The second book is from the point of view of his son, Lucius, who was a real man. There was a guy called Lucius Watson. Lucius does an extraordinary thing. He goes back to live in that island community after his father is murdered down there. He cannot believe that the father that he reveres, really, is this monster that's being painted in the newspapers and the tradition and everything. So he tries to find out the real story by interviewing people, and he risks his own life. He's making a list of all. He's trying to find out who was in that so-called posse. The posse was organized as a posse after they killed Watson, you see, so it made it easier for everybody. So that's his point of view, and it's what happens to him and what becomes of him. The third book is from Watson's own point of view, from boyhood in South Carolina, dealing with Ring-Eye Lige, as his father was called, to the point where he's coming in on his boat to this landing, and he sees in the dusk, he sees all these armed men waiting for him. And it's his call as to how to handle this. And one might think that he miscalled it to judge from the result. But on the other hand, I think also you say, well, maybe he knew this was going to happen. He was going to give it one last bluff anyway, because he had nowhere to go. I don't know. He represented so many different threads in our history and so many different things. The Civil War, our imperialistic period, remember, because after, you know, 1880, 1890, we really got into grabbing. We were a little bit late. The European countries got all the good stuff, and we settled for kind of third-rate Spanish properties all around the world, you know. But we got into a big imperial stuff there, and the attitudes, and then the great invention period, Edison and Ford, and all these people were, you know, and they were right there in Fort Myers. Poor Watson had to see these enormous, and he was a very, very able man. So I got at least curious about him, and then more and more sympathetic, and then, as I was saying to somebody earlier, I knew he actually by reputation was. I found that out. He was a very good storyteller. People would come from anywhere. And to that regard, I assumed he had a good sense of humor. Now, I have to assume that to say a thing like that, it means that I have a good sense of humor. I couldn't write about his sense of humor. So I probably have a sick, warped, laconic, black humor. But whatever it is, for better or worse, I gave it to Watson. I made it possible to write about it because I had a lot of fun. I don't mean I was doubled up with laughter at the typewriter, but it made it much more interesting to write about him, his whole take on things. So this last part is all from his point of view, right from beginning to end, the bitter end. Did I wander away from your
question? No, that's
hopelessly.
If I could just ask one more question, we'll open it up to you all. We've talked about fiction. I think we would be remiss if we didn't ask a little bit about some of the nonfiction, which has been, throughout his career, as you know, very interested in wild places and in social justice primarily. And if I might just ask one political question, I'm curious your thoughts about what you see going on with Tibet right now. We've all been reading about it. You spent a lot of time in that part of the world. You've spent your adult life as a practicing Buddhist, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what we're looking at now.
I think for Tibet, it's a very dangerous time. You know, it's a complicated story. I would like to be, and I usually am, knee-jerk, defending the underdog kind of guy. Here, we have to look carefully at the history. China does have a certain political claim on Tibet. You can't walk away from it. We can't pretend Tibet is this isolated nation that the Chinese have enveloping with their tentacles or anything like that. They do see it as part of China. And they are purposely, for political reasons, misinterpreting what the Dalai Lama is saying. He's not advocating a separation as a separate country. He says, we just want our identity our spiritual and our religious identity. We want to be autonomous in certain ways. We do not want it to be a nuclear dumping ground, as the Chinese are doing. And the Chinese have been extremely skillful about this. What they're working for is just to have eventually a plebiscite. They're dumping really thousands and thousands of Han Chinese people there. And the Tibetans aren't that numerous anyway. And in a very short time, these people are reproducing, of course, there's going to be more Han than there are Tibetans in Tibet. And then they're going to have a vote. And it's going to be a legal, democratic vote. And the Tibetan tradition will be gone. This is what the Dalai Lama is really most afraid of. They will lose their identity. This is what Israel should be worried about, but isn't quite worried about it enough, I think. I mean, but they know about it. I mean, you know, you're going to encourage a situation where you're going to have so many non-Israeli Palestinians living in Israel, and then you're going to have a vote, and they're scared of this, and that's why they're expanding, I think, the settlements and stuff. Whatever. The world is full of these delicate, tragic situations where a lot of real people are suffering very badly. Anyhow, a friend of mine is a guy called Robert Thurman. He's a great... He was a Tibetan monk himself as a young man, and he's now runs Asia Tibet House in New York. And he's an author and teacher, very, very brilliant guy. But he's a great pal of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And he just sent me his manuscript. It's called Why the Dalai Lama Matters. And they're trying to rush this book out as fast as possible. And what he is doing, he's offering the Chinese a face-saving way of getting out of this where everybody benefits, is his theory. I don't think they're going to listen because they've committed themselves to such a hard-nosed attitude. You can't go from calling a man a jackal and a predator on our nation, which they're doing with the Dalai Lama now, and switch around and say, okay, well, sure, let's be pals. You know, so I don't think it's going to work, but something has to work. The Dalai Lama is terrified that all these people who are rebelling are going to be killed. And the Chinese... God bless them, but they are very hard-nosed. They don't play games. They are very, very tough people. And saving face is very important. And so it looks like a horrible, you know, situation. And I don't really at the moment see any... I don't think Thurman's idea is going to be accepted. The Dalai Lama is threatening resignation if people start getting killed. He doesn't want people killed in his name, quite rightly. And... It's a great pity because there's nobody quite like him. He's, you know, he is sort of a fulcrum for so many things, and his record is just absolutely flawless. He's been the one consistent voice for reason, who is everybody in the world really, to one degree or another, reveres, except possibly the Chinese. He is the man that could bring that off if possible, but it may not be possible. He's worked so hard for it. That's all he does all year round. He works for this cause of his, and he'll talk to anybody. And he's not snobbish about dealing with people like Steven Seagal and Richard Gere. Actually, Richard Gere, I will say, I resist the idea of Hollywood people going over there and becoming spiritual gurus, but I think Gere actually is sincere. I think he's really put his, you know, money where his mouth is, or vice versa. And... But whatever, the Dalai Lama doesn't care. I remember I used to work with Cesar Chavez. I did a book on Chavez years ago, but I revered Chavez. He was an extraordinary man. And he said, my people people say, well, why are you talking to so-and-so? Why aren't you? And he said, my people are dying. My people are dying. They're being poisoned to death. Their backs are being broken using the short hoe. They're suffering terrible racism, which they were. And he said, I don't care. If they'll help my people, I'll talk to anybody. He said, we haven't the luxury of picking or choosing who our friends are. And I think the Dalai Lama is the same book.
Okay, I guess we would be happy to take some questions if anybody has one. Yes, sir, go ahead.
No, no.
And as one other, if I may, what is it that moves you from fiction to nonfiction and back and forth? How does that work? How do you sort of figure out what the next book is going to be?
Well, let me do the first one first. The return to Watson. A lot of friends of mine, including writer friends, said, why do you waste so much time and so many years over a guy who's arguably a sociopath and so forth? And it's because I think I became obsessed. I became fascinated to find out how this man worked as a human being, because he had many redeeming qualities, many. He had three wives, not all at once. He had three wives serially, and seven children by these three wives. All of these people, with one exception, one of his sons, adored him. He had many other ladies who adored him as well, and a few other children to show for that. This guy, he was, in a way, up to a point, was a very popular man and very much admired, but also very much feared. But I was interested in how he worked. How did this happen? How did he get this? This is why I'm not interested in the plot. Get it out of the way. The plot is not interesting. It's how did it get there? Who? How did that happen? And I just, you know, I felt that I didn't know him quite well enough. Now I know him well enough. I don't know who let go who, but one of us let go. You know. As for going back and forth, this is disputed. But I have always seen myself as a fiction writer. I never wrote anything but fiction for 8 or 10 years. And but I married, and I had two little kids, and I was doing a lot of odd. I became a commercial fisherman, and I ran a charter deep sea fishing boat out of Montauk, Long Island, for a few years. I did a lot of things to try to eke out, but I wasn't cutting the mustard. I wasn't, you know, I really wasn't. So I took up nonfiction as a way of putting bread on the table, so to speak. And luckily at that time, Mr. Sean, my friend at The New Yorker, came along, and The New Yorker bought, I think they bought about 10 of my books. They just bought the books and took out what they wanted. And in those days, they paid, you never asked them, they just paid so well. And I only had to make a couple of New Yorker hits every year, and I was golden. You know, and that freed me, that gave me the money to go and do my fiction, which takes much longer. And the nonfiction really, you know, you're reporting, and you're stuck with the facts, or you should be stuck with the facts. A lot of reporters are not so stuck with the facts. But as we see every day on our TV. So I went back and forth, and I give my best hours to the fiction. That was the morning, and I write nonfiction in the afternoon. That was true for years and years and years. I was doing one fiction and one nonfiction at all times. I run out of steam to doing that kind of thing. I actually, if I have my druthers, I will never begin a book of nonfiction again, ever. I'm only interested in fiction. I have a lot of nonfiction that's never appeared in book form. Environmental stuff and travel stuff and Buddhist stuff. And so I may very well put a few books together for my wife's estate and everything. But I don't want to embark on another nonfiction book. I really want to devote myself to fiction, and I don't know that I have the energy even to do that, because after 30 years, I'm so burned out. And I'm still, I'm doing a lot of, as usual, I'm working with Inupiat Eskimo people now. I'm doing a series of articles for the New York Review of Books on what's happening in the Arctic with global warming, but also big oil and the damage they're doing up there. Big oil is really ruthless. They're fudging on the truth, fudging on the facts. They just see so much money in this fossil fuel that's killing all the rest of us. You know, and I still get angry. I am very angry about it. And I was saying to somebody, it's coming out now, that even in the Department of the Interior, who are licensing them to do all this sonic blasting under the ice and all that, fouling the Arctic, they're going to make a sewer pit up there. And, of course, this is not only destroying the wildlife, but helping and speeding up the ice destruction, too. And it's going to wipe out the Inupiat communities. There are only a few of them. They're very small. And they're very precious. They're wonderful, wonderful traditions, and I just hate to see them go. So I've been up there working a lot. I'll finish that as a kind of a book. There's no end to it. You keep thinking you can kick back, but you never can. You can't turn your back on them for a minute, you know, these people.
Yes, go ahead.
I may be wrong, but in all the books, I always see you give voice to the natural world as well as the world.
Well, you know, I used to sort of be down my nose about my nonfiction, thinking, well, I got to do this to make a living and support the kids and stuff. But then a friend of mine, a dear old friend who was a painter, and he said, why are you bad-mouthing your nonfiction? He said, you know, you're really writing about the same things in fiction and nonfiction. It's almost always about the destruction of wildlife and nature and injustice to small minority groups, ethnic peoples. You know, he said, that's all your stuff. That's what you write about. And so from that point of view, and I have nothing against the nonfiction so much. It isn't that. I don't think it's necessarily bad or anything like that. It just isn't as much fun for me. You can't go to points of truth and imagination in nonfiction the way you can in fiction. That's my experience. With nonfiction, as I say, you are stuck with the facts. You're either a reporter or you're not. This is what the facts are. They're right there. Deal with them. Now, you can deal with them in a very inspired way, and sometimes in a kind of imaginative way, and sometimes the facts are so extraordinary you don't have to write fiction. That was true for when I began this book called The Snow Leopard. We walked across the Himalaya, 250 miles, in these incredible landscapes, and every week we went back, every week we went north, we went back in time 100 years. We were, by the time we got up there, it was about the 10th century. I mean, it was just extraordinary, you know. I remember saying to my partner, Dr. Schaller, I said, if I can't write a good book about this, I ought to be taken out and shot. it had kind of fictive legend, you know, legend sort of a quality. It didn't need fiction. It was just so extraordinary by itself. This is also true of a book I did on the Stone Age people in New Guinea. We did an expedition out there years ago, and we were just studying this war tribe out there. And again, you just went so far back in the past. This was an expedition, something you may remember. Michael Rockefeller was killed out there, and he was with us. That was another one. But most nonfiction is reportorial. And I've done an awful lot of it on Chicano people and on American Indian things, on environmental fights. I'm still in all the environmental fights. A bit bloody, but still in the ring.
Yeah. Yes, sir. What can we get a microphone over here? Well, just so everyone in the back can hear your question.
Microphone and everything. Well, I've been a big fan of yours for many years. I read a lot of your books and everything like that. And referring back to the cloud forest and when you did ayahuasca,
yeah,
and the influence it had on Allen Ginsberg, mm-hmm, and the Beatnik generation, mm-hmm, and your philosophy about that and how it matriculated over to your philosophy with Zen and everything like that. I'd like just for you to comment on that. In other words, do you still practice Zen philosophy? I did read the book. There was a book you wrote, I mean, it was in the 80s, about Zen philosophy. And
yeah. Yeah. Nine-Headed Dragon River.
Right, exactly. And yeah. There was some Zen philosopher that you were studying under who said pollution was part of the Zen, and you disagree with that. I think I'm being a little ambiguous or whatever, but
it's probably a very Zen observation you just made, but it went past me. I didn't get it.
No, well, no. But I mean, how do you put this all in prospect from the beginnings? You know, all your travels and all that stuff, and then going to Zen. And do you still practice that and everything, that type of thing?
Well, in the '60s, you remember the '60s back then, and. And I was very interested in Eastern thought, and I didn't have a teacher. I couldn't find a real teacher. And my late wife, she was in the same situation. So we ran into a guy, Dr. John the Night Tripper. He was an LSD guru, really. But what he was a pioneer. He really was. He said he'd been a conventional psychoanalyst for years and years and years. And he said, I can break through a patient with this stuff. It's just amazing. He said, I can deal better with 30 patients at least for everyone I was handling before, because this stuff is so magical, he felt. And I think he was right. I think he was right. If it was properly administered in the proper controllable doses, not made in somebody's garage, you know, the way they had it first, it was made in Switzerland by Sandoz, a very respectable pharmaceutical firm. It was very measurable. You knew exactly how many micrograms you were getting. And he was using it as a tool, and it was just terrific. Anyway, we did a lot of drugs in those days, and I experimented with a lot of others too. But in the cloud forest, I ran into one. A guy in the jungle gave to me. It's called ayahuasca. It comes from a plant called Banisteriopsis copi. It's also known as yagi. Even William Burroughs was daunted by ayahuasca. It's a very tough dose. It's kind of a woody thing. You've got to drink about a quart. You know, it's got sticks in it. You know, it's very bitter, and it's called the death vine because you feel it induces death. and I thought, well, I got to try this just for scientific purposes. So I tried it, and I described this experience in I put it into my novel, I Play in the Fields of the Lord, and I think it was a pretty good description of it. In fact, I had a letter from Timothy Leary, whom I didn't know, but he said, that's the best description in the literature, fiction or not, you know. And so I guess that's how it happened. But also my wife, and she did too, she wanted to try it, but she had such terrible trips that, you know, she was ready to find something else. And she got into practicing Japanese tea ceremony. And a wonderful woman who she met in the tea ceremony school took her over to the Zendo, a new Zendo that was being started in New York City. And I gradually drifted over there too. And that took the place of the drugs. I I wanted to do something that took you to those same clear areas without the chemical screen. That was the important thing. So I know it's not particularly. I know there are horrible horror stories about drug use. There are, and they're true. A lot of them are absolutely true. It was done irresponsibly. The kids went kind of wild in the 60s. They were dropping acid in people's coke, and kids were getting acid who didn't know, and they naturally thought they'd gone absolutely crazy. And they really, some people were very seriously psychotically damaged. It's strong stuff. But for me, it was just enormously clarifying and helpful. And I really know almost nobody who, if you could now get it administered responsibly by somebody in the proper doses made by a proper pharmaceutical company, it would benefit by it. Really, it was just a magical stuff. the 60s.
Go ahead.
Peter, thanks for all your work, especially the snow leopard. I'm going to ask two questions. If you don't want to answer both, you don't have to. One is about my favorite character in literature, who is Jean Chevalier.
Yeah.
I want to know about the inspiration behind him. And also, one of my favorite parts of the snow leopard is when Tuckton relays that generations-old story about the Yeti. Is the Yeti Gigantopithecus? Do you think so? I do. Thanks again.
What do you want to hear? Yeah. Okay. George Schaller, who was my partner in the Snow Leopard Trek, he's probably one of the most distinguished, if not the most distinguished, field zoologist working today. He's a very tough guy, born in Germany. He does not put up with nonsense. He's very pragmatic indeed. And I describe in the snow leopard, we were in Kathmandu before we set out, and a young biologist came in with this big plaster of Paris cast of a print that he'd found in the snow. And I thought Schaller was going to shoot this kid down, you know. And we got back to our hotel room. I said, that just looked like an old gorilla cast. He said, it does look like a gorilla cast. He said, but it's not, and it's different. I said, you're taking it seriously? He said, why shouldn't I? He said, that guy's I know about his work. He's a good biologist. He's not faking it. And then he told me about having seen photographs of Yeti prints taken by that British mountaineer. I've forgotten his name now. No. Different area entirely. he said, you know, I can't walk away from it. Schaller is a good scientist. His mind is open, so he is open to the Yeti. He's also, I know, he's not open necessarily to the Sasquatch, Bigfoot. See, what infuriates scientists is the Yeti and the Sasquatch, let's say they exist, they're not even closely related. So your conventional scientist says, oh, my God, first they got an abominable snowman, and now they got a Bigfoot. And these things are coming out of the woodwork, you know, these strange animals. But it's an open case in both, by the way, both species, I think. The evidence for them is a little bit stronger than the evidence against them. So who knows? Did I answer your question?
I think we have just time for one more question. Go ahead. I think let's just take one more from you, ma'am. Go ahead.
Yeah.
My question, I was a little startled by something you said, not to be political, but to paraphrase what you said. You talked about the fact that you thought China had some legitimate claims on Tibet. Is this pre-1950?
So exactly what did you mean?
No, it was gone. You have to go way back to the end of the 19th century. I think it was, I've forgotten where it got confused, but there was a British diplomat, kind of explorer, a guy called Francis Younghusband, and I've forgotten how that worked now. I'm kind of shaky on my memory is not as good as it was. But up until that time, there was a confusion about the political status of Tibet. And they had been seen, it was perceived at least, as being politically at least part of China or under China's dominion. Enough to give the Chinese an argument. That's the point. In other words, it isn't baseless. They didn't just wade in there as other countries might have done to Iraq. It wasn't like that. It was a little more confusing than that, a little bit more complicated than that. But nonetheless, I believe the Tibetans have the right here. They have the right to be their own because the culture is so distinct, and they are distinct people. And unfortunately, and we all know, we are stuck with an awful lot of, to my mind, rather casual treaty-making, map-making on the part of the colonial powers and the British, perhaps, maybe worse than anybody. They rather casually drew Pakistani, Bangladeshi borders, Iraq. There are many, many countries which are split, fragmented in their minorities, in their religions, in their ethnic traditions, everything, just for the convenience or political aggrandizement of the European and American powers. It's a pity because millions have suffered for this arbitrary colonialism. But anyway.
I think we're out of time, so let's say thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.